everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdrin, appearing to you by pirate satellite from Alpharetta, Georgia, escaping the hurricane, Barry. Barry, I've had a trying weekend, and we will get into that. My man, how are you doing this special episode 100?
I am doing fantastic, Jeff, and as you'll probably be hearing on the audio, this past week too, we've upgraded the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Ambler Studios. So now I'm on professional equipment. I had a team in here going through, installing, uninstalling, just doing a lot of shit that I don't understand, and hopefully my audio sounds a little bit better now, Jeff.
I will just say that your audio equipment is now Brian Last approved. Boom! I know we're happy to hear that. So today, Barry, we're doing, once again, episode 100. That's 100 episodes! I've been fucking Alpharetta and I haven't missed an episode, folks. Let me just point that out. Unsolved Mysteries Part Quattro. Yes, the fourth episode of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry to feature an Unsolved Mysteries aspect to it. We're going to get to that in a second. Point out a couple things real quick before we start here. First of all, I want to give a special shout out to my man, Richard Singer. Why am I giving a shout out to Richard Singer? Because Richard Singer, Barry Rose, was the very first subscriber, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry on YouTube. I would encourage all of you to subscribe to our channel. Special thanks to our man, Lou Kippelman, on the production duties there. So a shout out to Lou and a shout out to Richard Singer. Thank you, Richard. Suck it, the rest of you guys who didn't get there first, Barry. We're pretty happy about this.
Yeah, we're real happy. But Jeff, I don't just want to encourage people. Stop whatever you're fucking doing right now. After the show. Yeah, look, even if you want to, you can multitask. You can listen to the show. You can get on YouTube. Subscribe to this channel. It's really going to help us out in a bunch of different ways. It's going to spread the word, and it's going to make sure that Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry is going to be around for a long time. But Jeff, you just mentioned something too. You are in a hotel room with an air conditioning blasting in Alpharetta, Georgia. So Jeff, I've got a little checklist right here. We have done, this is our 100th episode. And we've done, how many, Lou, how many have you been with us? About 50% of those?
I think slightly less, maybe around 33%.
Mark that audio clip there, Lou. That'll be a good soundbite for
me. I say, yeah, cue the immigrant song.
which is, Jeff, it's pretty amazing too, but you know, I'm going to go through this, Jeff, and you just tell me. So 100 episodes, this is our 100th episode. We have never missed a week, which really, if I was to pass tomorrow, I would want on my tombstone, good husband, great father, never missed an episode. I think I'm, 96 episodes, 97 episodes? We've never missed an episode. Nope. That, I think of all this shit that I have fucked up, you know, and all this stuff I've missed and whatever, we've never missed an episode. Holy shit. That's amazing. We've never done a best of. We've never done any sort of highlight show or anything like that. So, Jeff, I'm just going to go through it too. So, dental issues and root canals. Have we faced that during the 100 episodes?
I believe we have.
We have marriages,
at least one.
Okay, illnesses.
I'm sure we've been sick at some point.
We have, actually, absolutely. Okay, college drop-offs.
Yes, we have.
Hurricanes.
Two, because this is the second one I escaped.
Two fucking hurricanes. That is pretty unbelievable. Well, Jeff, what am I leaving off of this list? Moves to Georgia.
Yeah, we're getting ready to take that challenge on in 2 weeks. So, yeah, I was telling the guys, especially before we start the Unsolved Mysteries, if you'll indulge me, I was telling the gentleman here that it's been quite the trying weekend in the Bowdrin household. Let me go over what we've got here. First of all, we got this fucking Hurricane Dorian off the coast, which as of this recording, they said is now up to 180 miles an hour, Barry. I don't know if you know that scale, but it might be a little bit destructive. And reports are out of the Bahamas that it is absolutely completely devastating to Grand Bahama Island. And it is projected. I'm just going to knock on a little break in kayfabe wood there, projected to skirt the coast of Florida. And I, of course, have my parents and my sister up in Jacksonville. I'm worried about them, but it is sort of veered away from South Florida and all my friends and family down there. I'm very happy about that. But so we got this that we're worried about. We're battening down the hatches, putting our shutters up at our home and trying to leave South Florida early because we're worried because I got to be honest with you, when Irma hit a couple years ago, the first hurricane we fled from, the traffic was insane with everyone trying to escape Florida. And that was a smaller hurricane, by the way. And so then we have that we're dealing with. So we're trying to get ready, trying to rent a car because we're bringing a few things up because we're not officially moving for another 2 weeks. Then we get word that my brother-in-law, Kent Morrison, my wife's brother, is in the hospital having surgery. Barry, they laid this one on us. Here, fill out the living will. You've got a 30% chance of surviving this surgery. That's the kind of thing that'll wake you up, huh, Bear?
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, and come to find out, oh, this is a little rough. He had the flesh-eating bacteria. He had a skin infection, and it ended up being the flesh-eating bacteria. They had to remove part of his thigh and his buttocks, and holy crap, they think he's God willing, right now he's in recovery and the doctors are very happy with the way he's recovering. But let's put it this way, Barry, the amount of surgery and tissue they had to remove, they had to bring in a plastic surgeon to figure out how they were going to suture the wound. And oh my God, I can't even imagine. And so he's got a long road. He's going to be in the hospital for at least a month. And so I want to send my best wishes on behalf of Barry and myself to my brother-in-law, Kent, his wife, Kelly, and daughter, Caitlin, because they've got a long way. So meanwhile, his wife, by the way, is dealing with her husband having surgery. And oh, by the way, he's got a 30% chance of surviving the surgery. And she's there by herself with her daughter, who is, dare I say, challenged. And because of that, she's got no one to get her house ready. And they think, you know, at the time that this happened, they were worried that the storm was coming right for Palm Beach. So no stress there, as you might imagine, Barry. So then Kim, my wife and I, we escape up through Florida after stopping off at my parents' house. And now we're in Georgia. We actually got the keys to our new home. So that's pretty exciting. But yeah, Barry, it's been a little stressful week for the Bowdrons here.
That's what it sounds like, too. And I had the opportunity to meet Kent and his wife, Kelly, at your daughter's wedding. So I was really sorry to hear that, too. And then to hear about the flesh-eating bacteria, because if I remember correctly, that was something when I was taking my last vacation to Anna Maria Island, you were cautioning me and was like, you know, fuck, isn't this near you? And I was like, yeah, somebody within a mile of the house I'm going to be at caught it right there on that beach. So it's definitely, it's not something to play with. And as you mentioned too, that fight, the fatality rate's high on something like that. But you know what, man, that is amazing that he's kind of pulled through this and is doing so well right now. So obviously our thoughts and our prayers are with your entire family during this. And do they listen? I know that your sister-in-law, Kelly, right?
She's
in the Facebook group. I know she's in. So, hey, you know what? We're all in Kent's corner on this one. Absolutely, Jeff. And certainly a stressful time for anybody on the East Coast right now. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay. Now, it is time for the fourth time here. I guess that's an average of about one every 25 episodes, Barry. Time for Unsolved Mysteries Part 4. So, Barry, I tell you what, I'm going to take the first at bat on this one. Okay. We are going to start off with Unsolved Mysteries. Who killed Garrett Phillips? Let me just give you a little bit of background on this. Garrett Phillips was a young man who lived up in upstate New York, and he was 12 years old. He was found strangled to death in 2011. His mom's ex-boyfriend, whose name was Nick Hillary, was arrested and charged with a crime. But this is a crazy, crazy case. This case was featured on an HBO special that I've mentioned sort of in passing in prior episodes. But when you do a deep dive on this case, this is really one for the books. It's just a crazy story. So they live in this very small town in upstate New York. In 2011, the town is absolutely rocked by this 12-year-old boy who was on his way home from school. He'd been riding his skateboard. There's surveillance cameras outside his, I believe his middle school or high school that the boy was, I don't know if he was going to a game or something. And they see him riding his skateboard. The kid heads for home, goes home, and is found dead sometimes a little bit later. They knew that he had been strangled. That was all they knew. And so here's where, and people love our little catchphrases on the show here, Barry. This is where we start going down the old rabbit hole. So they arrested Nick Hillary. Okay. Nick Hillary was a man who had been dating Garrett's mom. And let's just say that some people believe that one of the things that played a part in Nick Hillary being arrested was that Nick Hillary was one of the few black men who lived in this town. The town is Potsdam, New York, had been dating Garrett's mom. Garrett is was a white kid. And so there may have been there's a little bit of belief that there may have been a little bit of racial overtones. Oh, God, why would that happen in upstate New York, Barry? So he gets arrested. Well, it just so happens that another former boyfriend of the mom was a gentleman who worked for the sheriff's office. And let me see. His name was John Jones. So the mother comes in to be questioned. You know, they're doing the investigation on this case. They're trying to figure out what's going on. They bring in the boyfriend, and, you know, they're thinking immediately, you know, unfortunately, let's be honest, a lot of times when you hear about a child being murdered, you know, like you see it on the news, and the first thing you think of now, and it's horrible to say this, but you think it's got to be somebody in the family. You know, there's some sort of, especially when the parents aren't together, you know, and you think, oh, it's, you know, and then you got a boyfriend, and the boyfriend was Nick Hillary was like, I think the soccer coach at the school or at the local college or something like that. And so he'd been dating her. So she was also previously dating a guy whose name was John Jones, who worked for the sheriff department as a deputy. So they bring the mom in for questioning. Okay. And the ex-boyfriend sits in on the interview with the mom to find out where the mom was at the time your son was found killed and stuff like that. And so it was kind of strange that the mom had the ex-boyfriend for the sheriff coming in. I don't know whether it was emotional support or whatever. So they end up zeroing in on this Nick Hillary. Okay. And let's just say the investigation was one that was a little on the strange side, because they do like a strip search on Nick Hillary. They videotaped the strip search and such. And so there's a lot of beliefs again that there were racial overtones to this. So they end up charging Nick Hillary with the boy's death. Okay. Because they were on the videotape. I told you there's a videotape of the young man leaving his school. Okay. Well, on the videotape, he's leaving the school parking lot, hangs a left on his skateboard. He's going to his home. Well, Nick Hillary, who I think had broken up with the mom by this point, his apartment is, as you leave the school, to the right. Well, on that day, Nick Hillary leaves school grounds, turns left, as if, and I guess this is the supposition, he was following the young man, like stalking him or something like that, gets back to the apartment. And let me just say, there are all kind of weird things that have to do with this story. This story is almost 9 years old, and I can tell you that they still don't know what happened. Because what happens is Nick Hillary gets charged with a crime, okay? And as someone who's worked in the court system, I can tell you, Barry, that when a prosecutor is disbarred by the Bar Association because of allegations of professional misconduct and a quote, according to the judges in the Third Judicial Department, that she was exhibiting a pattern of disregard for defendants' rights, unquote. That's when you know things are kind of a little bit effed up. And so they still don't know, although the prosecutor who was disbarred was quoted as saying she absolutely believes that it was this Nick Hillary, the ex-boyfriend. And we're going to post a link to this story on our Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Facebook page, because it's really a fascinating story. Was it Nick Hillary being railroaded by this predominantly white town? Was the deputy that used to date the mother? And let's be honest, the mother is, let's just say nicely put, she sort of comes off like the town floozy. Okay. And then there's some accusations and supposition that maybe Nick was killed by one of his childhood friends by accident, because apparently there was some people that he hung out with, a group of kids, and they were worried they might've been, you know, roughhousing or something like that, and an accident happened, and somehow Nick Hillary got thrown. There's all kind of different suppositions here, Barry. So, but this is a crazy story. I'm going to post a link to this story. Check it out, because there are a lot of different roots to this story, if you will, Barry.
Gotcha. And how old was he?
He was 11 at the time he was killed.
Wow. So he wasn't like a small child. He was basically starting to.
I'm sorry, he was 12. He was 12.
So even, yeah, he was entering into his teen years. So, Jeff, you've done some research on this. What is your theory as to what happened to this young man?
You know, I got to be honest with you. When I watched the HBO special, it was told in, I think, in two parts. And the beginning of the first part, I started watching it, and I really thought Nick Hillary looked like a guy that, you know, might have done this because, you know,
right.
Ex-boyfriend pissed off with the mom. Maybe the reason they broke up is because the young kid, you know, was pushing back on the relationship. I mean, think about it, you know, and I hate to put it this way. You're a 12-year-old boy in a predominantly white town who's got to deal with friends at school, and your mom is dating one of the few black guys in town. He's a soccer coach and stuff like that. But, you know, the boy is getting pushback about that from his friends at school.
Sure.
Okay. So now the kid is PO'd because mom's dating a black guy. And, you know, you wonder whether or not that, you know, okay, so now mom breaks up with the black guy. Maybe the boyfriend is in love with mom for whatever reason and is pissed off now at the kid for causing this relationship to break up. He goes to speak to the kid. Something happens. That's just one possible idea. Okay. Then, you know, you got the other ex-boyfriend, the sheriff's deputy, who, doesn't seem to be 100% innocent. He's got something to do with this. I just have that belief. Sure. So, like I said, lots of layers to this story. But we'll post a link to the story because I think it's something. And you can, of course, I'm sure go to like one of the HBO Now or something apps and pull up this story. It's a like I said, it's told in two parts, 1 hour each. It's called "Who Killed Garrett Phillips?" And it's a really, really interesting story, Barry.
It is too, and I'll tell you. So I've seen it listed on HBO, and because of the subject matter, I was like, you know, maybe I'll watch Summer School for the millionth time instead of something so heavy. But now knowing a little bit of the backstory of what happened and the fact that it still is an unsolved mystery, maybe tonight's viewing will be this. Yeah, that's a shame. That's a real shame. Whenever we have a story, it's much like you with the animals, Jeff. If we ever have a story and children have either been murdered or, you know, something terrible has happened, it always is troubling to me.
Yeah. So, Barry, absolutely. What's your first story?
So, do you remember a TV actor, Jeff? You and I are roughly the same age. I'm a little younger, but do you remember? And Lou is the youngest of the three of us. But do you remember a TV actor, good-looking guy, kind of all-American from the 1970s by the name of Dennis Cole?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Dennis Cole was
married to Jacqueline Smith, wasn't he?
Absolutely, which was probably really his claim to fame in a lot of ways. But Dennis Cole was one of those guys that was I don't think he ever had this great success as an actor. And I can't tell you what his resume says, but I can tell you if you were around in the 1970s, he was on literally probably every TV show, Love Boat, you know, Starsky and Hutch, like all of those types.
I'll give you a comparison, Barry.
Sure.
Sort of a Doug McClure. Doug McClure?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Doug same McClure. Kind of status.
Another guy, too, Clue Gulager, if you remember. Yeah, exactly. So they were on, if it was a Quinn Martin production at that stage, these guys were going to be on it. But Dennis Cole was everywhere. He literally was everywhere. Married to Jacqueline Smith. You know, it was like Barbie and Ken almost. You had this perfect, beautiful couple. And then, you know, I think as he got a little bit older, the parts were a little less frequent. He did divorce Jacqueline Smith. But he had a son from his first marriage named Joe Cole. And Joe was a guy that had spent most of his life in and around the Los Angeles area. You know, I think he's classified as an actor, writer. He was also a roadie for Hole, Black Flag, the Rollins Band. He'd written a book called Planet Joe, which was about his time being a roadie, being on the road. And it was kind of a journal. And he documented the final Black Flag tour. And Black Flag, you know, familiar or not, but, you know, really one of the most, if not the most influential American punk bands in the history of the genre. So, you know, Joe was a guy that I think was trying to do his own thing, was really, really close with Henry Rollins. And he was at the time of his murder, which is where we're going with this, Jeff. When Joe Cole was murdered, he had been documenting the lives of homeless Vietnam veterans on Venice Beach. So he had a house on Venice Beach with Henry Rollins. And I know you're familiar with Henry Rollins. Henry Rollins was in Black Flag and then left and started the Rollins Band. But he's a poet. He's an author. He's an actor. He's a raconteur, because Henry Rollins, I think, has literally done everything that there is to know. He was the best friend of Joe Cole. So these two lived together. They lived in a house. pardon me, Jeff. They lived in a house in the Oakwood section of Venice Beach, California. They were roommates. And that area was known as the ghost town portion of Venice, notorious for crime, lack of safety. And Rollins has since described it as a crack neighborhood. So really, this is a tough – and Venice is beautiful. Like, you get to Venice Beach and it's real nice, but you know, I've never been to the bad neighborhoods, but apparently, you know, you go out maybe just a few blocks or a mile or so, and it drastically changes. Well, on the evening of December 19th, 1991, Joe Cole and Henry Rollins had actually attended a Hole concert at the Whiskey A Go-Go on Sunset Boulevard, and they were headed home. But before they got home, they stopped at a place called Boys Market, creatively titled Boys Market. They were returning to their Venice Beach home around 12:40 a.m. when two armed men, described as black and in their 20s, approached them demanding money. Angry that Rollins and Cole only had $50 between them on their own person, the gunmen ordered the two men to go inside their house for more cash. Rollins entered at gunpoint. However, Cole stayed outside. Rollins made it in the house. Rollins heard two shots. He ran out the back door and I guess went and found police and brought them back. So as it turns out, Joe Cole, who was 31 years old, the son of Dennis Cole, had been shot in the face at close range and was dead. Rollins, as I mentioned, had escaped out the back door, alerted police. The police arrived within minutes. Joe Cole dead. Killers vanished into thin air. So a lot of speculation on this one, too. It's, you know, it's, you've got two kids, and, you know, Joe Cole was a good looking kid. He didn't look like his dad, but he was just a nice looking kid. Henry Rollins has always kind of looked like a badass, you know, regardless of that. But you've got an area that is that's heavily influenced by crime, and you've got these two kids in there, you know, and when I say kids, again, late 20s, early 30s, Joe Cole was 31. What could go wrong? Well, obviously a lot went wrong. So a lot of speculation. To this day, they have never found the killers of Joe Cole. But a lot of speculation. So a lot of the speculation goes first around Rick Rubin. Now, you're familiar with Mr. Rubin. I'm sure you are, Jeff, right?
Oh, sure. He was the money man behind Smoky Mountain Wrestling, besides being a legendary producer of music.
Exactly right on both counts. So he was the guy that was funding a lot of Jim Cornette and Smoky Mountain Wrestling. But he's a legendary movie music producer, and has been too, for some 40 odd years or something like that. And he's known. He's got this really long beard for years. It was a really long black beard. He would always wear sunglasses. Was kind of his trademark. The beard is now gray, but he's still a very successful producer. So he went to the house. This was about 2 days before the murder occurred, and he showed up in his Rolls Royce. So you've got a house with two white guys in a predominantly African-American neighborhood. There is a lot of crime in this neighborhood. You've got a guy showing up in a Rolls Royce. So Rollins, actually, the night that Rubin showed up, he went and he wrote in his journal that said he was very concerned that with Rick Rubin showing up, essentially flashing his wealth in front of everybody, that he thought the house was going to get done over by the locals. And he was right, because the house was. Rollins did go on the Howard Stern show later and say it was pre-planned. They patted us down to see if we had guns, which I thought was interesting. And that kind of stood out to me, Jeff, too, because, you know, if you're going to rob two guys outside of a house and you're patting them down, what does that say to you? Like, what would you, you know?
Yeah, this doesn't sound like something that was just very random.
Right, exactly. You're patting down guys during a burglary? What is, you know, that doesn't really happen. So I thought that was kind of odd. According to Henry Rollins, there were also bullets fired in the house and holes in the walls that had just narrowly missed him. So Henry quotes that. I haven't seen a police report that is backed that up, but I'm not disputing that. I just haven't actually seen a police report that says that. So even though Rollins provided police with a very detailed description of the killers, they failed to turn up any tangible leads to identify them. And as I mentioned, the murder remains unsolved to this day. Henry Rollins is a guy that was extremely close with Joe, obviously, and actually keeps a container filled with the soil that was soaked with Joe's blood. So that story has taken on mythical proportions, like he's got portions of his brain in a vial in his house. That's not really it, but he cleaned up I guess the dirt where the blood had soaked into, and he keeps that with him I guess at all times. So there were a bunch of theories going around at exactly what had happened. One was, which was the very easy theory, this was a targeted burglary, and it was done because, again, you had a guy showing up with a Rolls Royce. Word may have spread that Henry Rollins lived in the house. I believe he had some sort of a TV show at that stage when this was occurring. So I think it was local to Los Angeles. So word may have spread that that you know there's a guy on TV in there. He's got to have a lot of money. That area too is known for the Venice Shoreline Crips, which is a I guess an offshoot of the Crips street gangs. So, you know, people that you really don't want to fuck with, Jeff. I know I personally don't fuck with any street gangs.
I try to avoid that situation also.
Yeah, it's really, if you've got to have some sort of credo in your life, that's probably one of the better ones to do. However, there were a couple of things that came up. So Dennis Cole, the late Dennis Cole, who actually, if I'm correct, Jeff, actually moved down to South Florida, somewhere in Lauderdale, and became a realtor in his later years before he passed away, which is two or three years ago. But Dennis Cole appeared on various TV shows, and apparently he was never the same after his son was killed. And understandably, this completely devastated him. And he claimed that Henry knew more than what he was telling authorities, and that he knew who the killers were. Rollins then claims to have reached out to Dennis Cole after the TV appearances and told him to, quote unquote, back off or face the consequences. When pressed about that, he stated legal consequences. So, I'm not quite sure that, you know, Henry Rollins is going to call Dennis Cole and say, back off, motherfucker, I'm going to beat your ass, but probably did threaten to sue him. But Dennis Cole had a theory that revenge may have been a motivating factor in Joe's murder, and that Rollins might have possibly been the intended target. It was said, and this is a rumor, I believe the Globe newspaper printed this, Jeff, that Rollins had a large cachet of Nazi and World War II memorabilia in his house, and it was believed that Rollins had angered some of the people in Venice Beach, California. So Rollins, and again, Rollins has disputed that. Rollins went on Howard Stern and said, no, that was not the case. But Dennis Cole went on TV and basically said he did have this Nazi memorabilia, or had heard that he had this. Another theory that was out there was that this was over drugs, that somehow it was some sort of drug deal that had gone bad. The only thing that I'm aware of, and I don't know about Joe Cole, but I can tell you Henry Rollins is kind of anti-drug, or at least used to be. He was not a drug guy. He was an alcohol guy. He was a guy full of a lot of rage, but he wasn't really a drug guy. So that one I don't know about. I'm going to go with the theory that and I certainly don't want to blame the Venice Shoreline Crips, Jeff, for the obvious reason.
Let's make that clear.
They're
not
great guys. No problem here whatsoever. Wonderful people. But I get the feeling that Henry Rollins knew who the killers were. If he didn't know them by name, he certainly knew who they were. But because he wanted to live, he wasn't going to put the proverbial finger on these So whether it was, you know, just local street toughs or maybe it was some sort of organized crime, it seemed like Henry realized that maybe I just better keep my mouth shut, not say a word. I am going to go with the fact that there's a couple of things that don't really add up with this. You know, why did Henry go in the house? Why didn't Joe go in the house? Henry ran and was able to escape the other guy in the house. Joe obviously wasn't. It's all circumstantial. And Jeff, after almost 35 years in the court system, we both know about circumstantial evidence. But it does appear that there was actually more to this story.
Let me ask you real quick, sure, just to clarify something. So sure, they're outside the front door. And two guys, I'm guessing that were either masked or they didn't see their faces, come up and they got some sort of weaponry and they're sticking them up before they go into burglarize the house. Am I clear so far?
Yeah. So everything that I get from exactly what happened, and Henry Rollins has documented this and he's discussed this numerous times, but they were walking back to the house. As they were approaching their house, two guys, and I don't believe they were wearing masks, but two guys approached them. They robbed them. They patted them down, and they were mad that they only had $50 on them, so they ordered them in the house. I don't know the circumstances that dictated that only Henry Rollins goes in the house and Joe Cole doesn't go in the house. But again, Henry Rollins was able to escape through a back door, went and got the police, and he lived. Joel Cole did not, was shot in the face and died.
So what I'm asking, though, is so Henry Rollins goes into the house, like maybe like shuts the door and runs towards the back door to get away and sort of, dare I say, kind of bags his friend there, leaves his friend to deal with these two guys with the guns.
Yeah, so and there's been a lot of discussion of that, and certainly if you look at various message boards, whether they're punk rock message boards or even Rollins message boards, a lot of people are going to say that. But there is a large group of people that will also come out, and if there's the cult of Henry Rollins that will come out and defend him regardless. But yeah, so what he figured was when he heard the shots, he thought he was going to be killed next, and figured he'd better get the hell out of there. And that's what he did.
Okay. No, that's survival of the fittest. I'm sure.
In a sense, it's hard to, you know.
I mean, it's perfectly understandable, although it is bad for your punk credibility. Let's just say that. So it's definitely kind of an interesting case. Dare I say we can post a link, put it up on the old Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Berry board there, Mr. Rose?
Yeah. Absolutely, too. And 28 years later, there has never been an arrest. There has never been a suspect named. And you'd have to think 28 years later that will never happen either.
So, okay. So now it's time for my second story. I'm going to give a little Breaking Kayfabe credit here to my physical therapist, Won Mi. By the way, let me tell you a really funny Won Mi story. Won Mi is from Korea. She is the young lady that works with my wife with Select Physical Therapy, who is trying to help me deal with shoulder issues. They're not sure if I have a torn labrum or a torn rotator cuff. I got that from pitching in the majors for all those years, Barry. So Won Mi, while we're doing therapy, asked me, oh, what was your top five this week? Because I told him, you know, at the last visit that we had done the songs with colors in the title. So now I got them all the people in the office there are interested in the old Breaking Kayfabe. I'm sure that means our numbers are going to rise, Barry. So Won Mi tells me, I told her we were going to do an Unsolved Mysteries episode. Won Mi directs me towards the story of Rebecca Zahau. Now, let's not get this confused with friend of the show. No, not her husband, Shannon Zaha. We're not going to get them confused with the Zaha family. And we're dealing only with Shannon because Shannon had the post of the week the other day. But
dare I say, Jeff, post of the year.
Yes.
that was pretty fucking epic.
She owned her husband there. Yes. So, yes. But getting back to Rebecca Zahau was a young lady who was originally, I believe, from Burma, who was killed on July 13th, 2011. So, again, I want to thank my friend Won Mi for directing me to this story. This is a crazy, crazy friggin' mystery that, again, has never been solved. Rebecca Zahau was the girlfriend of a man named Jonah Shakna. I think that's how you pronounce it. It's anyway, so on July 13th, 2011, Rebecca was found at the mansion that she shared with her boyfriend, hanging and had an apparent suicide. She was bound by the ankles and with her hands behind her back, which makes it a little hard to do suicide when you've got that. But anyway, so immediately there was all kind of suspicion as to how this woman really died, or was it in fact a suicide? So again, much like the first story I talked about and the third story I'm going to talk about, lots of roots to this story, folks, because apparently a few days before this, by the way, Jonah Schock, now let me just point out, is the CEO of Medicis Pharmaceutical. When you're the CEO of a pharmaceutical company, Barry, guess what? You got a little scratch, I'm guessing. So yeah. They lived in this huge mansion in Coronado, California, which I believe, I don't know if it's a suburb of San Diego or if it's in the San Diego area. And you know, when they call your house a compound, you know that you're dealing with a large home. So, but what had happened, unfortunately, was a few days before the suicide of Rebecca, Jonah's son, Max, who was 6 years old, had an incident where he apparently fell down some stairs while he was playing and had to go to the hospital, where he unfortunately passed away. So it was a very, obviously very serious fall that resulted in the boy's death. So at that point, Jonah's brother, Adam, comes in to stay at a, I don't know if it's a bungalow or a cabin that's on the estate grounds. And then Jonah leaves, I don't know if it's on business or whatever, but he leaves town. Okay. And he was out of town, I believe. I want to say when his son even died, he was out of town. So then what happens is they're doing investigations, trying to figure out, you know, if this woman's suicide was in fact a suicide. Because, of course, as I said, your feet are bound, your hands are bound behind your back. You know, is this something that is actually something that someone can do when they're committing suicide? They're doing all sort of tests, you know, with the slip knots and the ropes to see whether or not someone can physically do this, tie their hands behind their back and still, you know, commit suicide. Where I believe she jumped off a ledge outside the house and, you know, had the rope around, I want to say a gate or something. So it was a ledge attached to the second floor of the home. So on September 2nd, 2011, the San Diego sheriff announced the death was a suicide and that the young boy's death was accidental. Neither was a result of foul play, according to what they said. So Rebecca's family filed a lawsuit against the brother who was living on the grounds that night, who had apparently he'd come in because, of course, his nephew had been injured. Now, according to the brother, he was on the grounds in the bungalow and had taken a sleeping pill and was asleep the night of the, you know, I'm just going to say for the record, you know, just to be clear, the suicide. Okay, we'll call it that for now. So they filed a lawsuit claiming that he was somehow culpable or responsible for this woman's death. Maybe he had in fact murdered her. Okay, they filed a $10 million wrongful death lawsuit against the brother. The case goes to a civil trial. Now, Barry, I'm sure when you talk about a wrongful death, probably the one that most people are most familiar with is, of course, the dreaded OJ case, where he was found not guilty in a criminal court. But the standard or the burden in a civil trial is much less than it is in a criminal trial. And a criminal trial, of course, is beyond a reasonable doubt. You're either guilty or not guilty. And so right, sorry, back to you. Jeff. Right back to you, motherfucker. I'm getting sorry, FaceTime man. By my co-host. So what happens is I completely ran off the train there.
Sorry.
So where the hell was I if you were listening? Okay. So I'm sorry. I remember now. Criminal case, burden of proof is reasonable doubt. That's a very high standard. Okay. In a civil case, it is a preponderance of the evidence, meaning it could be 50.1% to 49.9%. And the, you know, the prevailing or the larger, whoever has the larger, amount wins. Okay. So it's a much smaller burden if you're suing someone civilly, what are you looking for, Barry? You're looking for money. Okay. Whereas of course, if you're doing criminal, then your liberty's at stake. You can go to jail or even worse. Okay. Especially in a case involving a death. So they sue the brother and the family wins the lawsuit. Okay. So the brother appeals it. After the case is appealed, it comes back from the appellate court in favor of the brother who had been sued, and they dismiss the case with prejudice, meaning that the family cannot refile the case. So now, again, this leaves the proverbial open wound with the family. who killed Rebecca Zahow. That is the story. So Rebecca Zahow, as I said, she was from Burma, and she came in. And so, Barry, did you get a chance to look at this case at all?
I did. I looked at it briefly, too. And so Burma, also known as Myanmar. There seems like there's some holes, though, in the detective work. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious that, you're dealing, and may I say, much like when you're dealing with a OJ case, you're dealing with a person of either a great wealth, celebrity. A lot of times that can taint a lot of cases when you're dealing with someone of some notoriety, Barry. So, yeah, and what may look like a very pat solution. Oh, yeah, the woman killed herself. And then you start doing, after the case is over. And one of the things I should mention apparently is when the brother placed a call to the police department saying, look, my brother's girlfriend, I don't know if she was his fiance or just a girlfriend at the time, has killed herself. He went and cut her down.
Oh.
Of course, now the crime scene has been tampered with. And so let me just make sure that's what happened. I wanted to make sure that was accurate.
And I want to verify this one thing you said. So it was classified as a suicide, but her hands were tied behind her back.
Yes.
Okay. So how would, in theory, if you were and you're not a medical examiner, Lou, are you a medical examiner, Lou?
No.
No. So let me ask you a question. How does somebody commit suicide and hang themselves with their hands tied behind their back? I mean, and then how is this classified as a suicide unless there's a massive cover-up? Am I wrong?
Yeah, that it's definitely very. So let me show you something else, or tell you something else that I'm just I'm reading as I'm following up my notes here. So according to the autopsy, there was evidence she went over the balcony in a non-vertical position and that she may have struck her head on the balcony on the way down, because there were four instances of head trauma, meaning that she struck her head four times when the body was – so she didn't necessarily jump to her death. So she would have to be dropping down directly downward and may have hit her head on the structure from which she was hanging. So, this is not your typical – I mean, I hate to say it, but usually when someone wants to hang themselves – they, put the noose around their neck and jump down. They don't dive head first down, which, that's just very – there's, a lot of tentacles to this story. It's still an unsolved situation. And this is the other one. There was a note attached at the crime scene. Painted on the wall inside the mansion was a note that said, quote, "She saved him. Can he save her?" And they've never been able to figure out who wrote that note, although they suspected the brother. But – they can never figure out who did it or what it meant. So another little twist to this story, and definitely a kind of aspect of the story is the cryptic note.
Yeah, it's unbelievable too. And so also, so she would have had to have jumped horizontally when you said that she didn't jump vertically, right? So when everybody's going to commit suicide and jump, they always do it in a horizontal position? What?
That makes no sense whatsoever.
Exactly. That makes zero sense. Wow, this sounds like a massive cover-up. And no doubt, if the boyfriend was a CEO of this major company, it sounds like somebody who had some wealth got away with murder.
Yeah. So, all right, Barry, what's your second story?
So my second story, Jeff, is the murder of Peter Ivers. Are you familiar with Peter Ivers?
Not right off the top of my head.
Gotcha. So, Jeff, I've been writing a book since the Lincoln administration on at least researching it as well on the history of new wave music. And one of the things I stumbled upon was Peter Ivers. So Peter Ivers was a musician, a songwriter, and a TV personality, as well as a Harvard graduate. So he was no dummy. Muddy Waters once described him as the greatest harmonica player alive. He opened for such acts as Fleetwood Mac, the New York Dolls, and John Cale. Also scored the David Lynch film Eraserhead, as well as, Jeff, one of your favorite films, the Ron Howard film Grand Theft Auto. He also wrote songs for the Pointer Sisters, Diana Ross, numerous others. He was great friends with John Belushi, Harold Ramis, Doug Kenny, if you remember Doug Kenny from Animal House. He played Stork, was also the founder of
National Lampoon. What the hell you want to do, you moron?
What the hell you want to do, you moron? Ivers also was dating film executive Lucy Fisher for many years. She would become the VP at Warner Brothers, overseeing such films as Men in Black and Jerry Maguire. But how I got connected to Peter Ivers was he was in charge, and he basically was running this show, was the host, but also one of the producers of this show that was airing in Los Angeles called New Wave Theater. And it was airing on a TV station out there in LA called KSCI, but was also shown as part of the weekend programming Night Flight, which was on USA Network. Do you remember that?
Yeah, no, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Like, was it Bobby Slayton was like one of the hosts, and they would have like all these comedians. But anyways, they were showing the show and I remembered seeing it. So as I started to dig around, I was like, oh, I remember this guy. He was this kind of effeminate little guy. You know, he wasn't this big, outrageous guy. He was kind of this petite, slightly effeminate guy, but he was the host of the show. However, on March 3rd, 1983, Jeff, Peter Ivers was found bludgeoned to death with a hammer inside of his Los Angeles loft space apartment. So here was a guy that was, you know, he obviously, again, you graduate from Harvard, and there's not a lot of schmucks graduating from Harvard. You're fairly intelligent at that point. So he graduated from Harvard, had built this career around himself, and he's found bludgeoned to death by a hammer in his apartment. But a lot of questions immediately come up too. In the hours following his death, the LAPD officers that were sent to the house, they failed to secure the scene. Now, you and I have talked about this previously. You fail to secure the scene, you have completely contaminated the entire crime scene. That's exactly what happened. They let many of his friends and acquaintances come to the house, and they were going in and out of the house. They were so inept that years later, the police couldn't even locate essentially what's called the murder book, which was detailing the case. As they went to reopen the case, somebody had somehow misplaced the murder book. So, you know, just
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, you know what? You got a murder book, you got to fucking lock and key that. Am I right? You have to. Okay. But, you know, so Ivers, too, he didn't live in a regular L.A. apartment. It was a loft in an upscale neighborhood called the Arts District, but then it was kind of filthy and dangerous and was kind of known as the heart of Skid Row. So there were a lot of people that were outside that, I guess, given the opportunity to get inside the house, certainly could have either committed a crime, whether it was burglary, murder, etc. But many people that were squatting in those buildings and the local residents kind of had this very secretive, self-sufficient culture. And I always thought, you know, as I read this too, I think that actually had an impact on how the case was investigated or not investigated. There were some suspects that actually came up with this. So the first suspect was a gentleman by the name of Harold Ramis, Jeff.
Yeah, I think we've heard of that name before.
I was going to say, familiar with Harold Ramis? Yes, you are. So Harold Ramis was briefly considered a suspect in the murder because Peter Ivers had a very close relationship with Harold's wife, but he was ruled out. He established an alibi, and he was able to, you know, basically went away quick. Another theory, which was interesting, was that it might have been one of the bands that was connected to the show. So the show that this Night Flight that was, you know, the New Wave Theater, it really was featuring punk bands and featuring hardcore punk bands. So it wasn't getting like Kaja Goo Goo or maybe some of the more gentle, you know, New Wave bands. Like they had Fear on. And Fear with Lee Ving, that's a fairly hardcore band right there. Well, a lot of these bands appeared to have contempt for him. And again, it might have been the fact that you had these real hardcore punk guys who, you know, they don't take two shits. They don't give two shits. They were looking for a rumble, and you've got this guy who's a little light. And you know, there was a theory that possibly one of these bands. That's just a theory. Lee Ving, though, there is a clip that's out there. He's being interviewed by Peter Ivers, and Lee Ving is giving him the look like he's going to beat the shit out of him right on the air. But several of Ivers' friends, they told the biographer of Ivers that there was a book written about this murder, and the guy's name is Josh Frank, but they suspected somebody, and they suspected a guy by the name of David Jove. Are you familiar with that name at all?
No, I'm not.
So David Jove was a former Canadian child actor, but was also known as the Acid King and was a notorious drug source in music circles. He was also a member of the Rolling Stones entourage at one point.
Man, I can't believe the Rolling Stones would have anything to do with anything having to do with drugs.
Well, they did, Jeff. And if you remember, it was 1967 or 68 when a raid on their house in England, and both Keith Richards and Mick Jagger were both arrested. Well, this guy, David Jove, is the one that set them up. He was working with the British government and basically turned evidence, and they did a raid on the house. When that occurred, so already he's got a strike that he's a snitch, he's a rat, and he sets these people up. He's setting up Jagger and Richards. But when that happened, he fled Britain and he moved to LA. So it was a guy that, you know, not a great guy. You know, take out the drug aspect. I'm not making a judgment on that. But the fact that you rat out your friends and then you flee the country and you go start a brand new life for yourself in Los Angeles, that's kind of shitty. Harold Ramis, the aforementioned Harold Ramis, noted that as I grew to know David a little better, it just accumulated. All the clues and evidence just made me think he was capable of anything. I couldn't say with certainty that he'd done anything, but of all the people I knew, he was the one person I couldn't rule out. That was interesting. So there was this David Jove kind of wave that was riding where people were thinking, you know, this would be the guy that possibly might have done it. Two things stand out about this. First off, officers, and I'm not making this up, Jeff, because I read this from several sources. Officers allowed David Jove to leave the blood-stained blankets from Ivers' bed. So he basically went to Ivers' bed in the loft, took the blood-stained blankets, and left the premises with them.
Oh, why would he, you know, right. You know, why would officers do that? You know, certainly there's no clues in the blood-stained blanket.
No,
of course not.
And how much of a sweet talker must this guy have been? You know, I just have to get my blankets. They were a gift from my great-great-grandmother. She made these, and I got to get
Nana.
Them. And pleased. Nanny did it for me. Exactly. So that's a little crazy. Secondly, David Jove, who had no alibi, Jeff, claimed he'd blacked out and couldn't recall his whereabouts at the time of the murder. Look, maybe it's hindsight. Maybe the fact that we're talking about this over 36 years later, but I don't know. Guy's got no alibi, claims he's blacked out, couldn't recall his whereabouts, leaving with blood-stained blankets from the murder scene. I don't know. Maybe this guy should have been investigated a little bit deeper. However, he did have a couple of defenders. Durf Scratch. You're familiar with Durf Scratch from the band Fear?
Big
fan. Several other members of the Los Angeles punk and new wave scene have basically said David Jove could never have done it and was innocent. That is all speculation, would have to be my assumption, because again, he didn't have an alibi. So David Jove was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, died in 2004 at age 61 in Los Angeles. However, on his deathbed, he was asked, do you want to come clean? Do you know anything about the murder of Peter Ivers? And he continued to say he was innocent, that he didn't. Moving on, Jeff, do you know who David Jove's daughter is? And I know you don't, so it's a loaded question. Jeff, what is the first movie we ever discussed on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry?
Easy Money.
Do you remember when I told you that the youngest daughter had become this world-renowned violinist?
Yes, that's right. I remember her.
She's the fucking daughter of David Jove.
Wow.
Right?
Solid movie trivia right there.
Yeah, who would have known? I didn't know. So about five weeks after the murder.
100 episodes, it all has come in full circle, Barry.
It is. It's like this whole fucking 6 degrees separation. But about 5 weeks after the murder, Lucy Fisher, again, the longtime girlfriend of Peter Ivers, paid for a private investigator to investigate the crime. The investigator interviewed a number of people who knew Ivers, but due to the botched initial investigation, lack of evidence, and lack of witnesses, the renewed investigation came out to nothing. However, he did state, "I do not believe it was a break-in. I do not believe it was just someone off the street that Peter brought in because he was a nice guy that night. I'm not buying it." Josh Frank and Charlie Buchholz, the two authors of the book about Ivers' life and his mysterious death, it's called In Heaven, Everything is Fine, The Unsolved Life of Peter Ivers and the Lost History of New Wave Theater, published by Simon & Schuster in 2008, do believe that at some point Jove was responsible for the death. If he physically wasn't, then they think that he actually knows more to it. On the basis of new information presented in the book, the Los Angeles Police Department's cold case department reopened the investigation. What they discovered was one last piece of evidence that I don't think anybody else was talking about, and nobody else really even said much about it. However, Peter Ivers, roughly 4 hours before being killed, had gone to David Jove and said that he had just sold one of his screenplays and was going to be leaving New Wave Theater.
Yeah, so I don't suppose that a blanket was ever recovered. Probably lost it somewhere along the way. Nana's blanket.
Nana's blanket, yeah. Lost, could be out to sea. It's been burned. It's been buried. Whatever, it's gone. But really, really interesting because everything seems to point to David Jove, who was afraid of losing essentially what it sounds like, losing his weekly paycheck.
His meal ticket. Yeah, sure.
You know, this guy he finally sold a screenplay after years of writing screenplays, was off to do his own thing. And what, 4 hours later, bludgeoned to death with a hammer. So,
wow.
Yeah. Sad, okay. A sad tale.
No, absolutely. And again, we'll post a link to that story also. So, and again, the name of the book is called In Heaven, Everything is Fine, The Unsolved Life of Peter Ivers and the Lost History of New Wave Theater. So, Barry, I'm going to call a little audible here at this point.
Uh-oh.
Because my last story has so many layers to it, I'm going to have you go next with your third story, and then I'm going to wrap up the show because when I tell you the stuff that I got on my third story, it's going to curl your hair, what is left of it. So I guess that means your eyebrows.
My eyebrows and my my very well-manicured beard. So back-to-back, Jeff, I'm honored to be able to do this, obviously. First time we've ever done it where we've gone back-to-back with stories. So, Jeff, as I've done with previous episodes, I always want to have a wrestling connection. The last time we did this, it was about Toadstool Tank, the murder of Tank Morgan and his huge, thick penis, as we
should. Allegedly.
Allegedly, that Pat Patterson was looking at in the showers. So that was a hell of a story. Pat Tank Morgan's killer, since this last episode, has still not been caught. So I don't think he will be. But Jeff, we're going to discuss the murder of another professional wrestler, a guy that was around in the late 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, a guy by the name of Mark Tendler. Do you remember Mark Tendler at all?
I do not.
So Mark Tendler was a guy that I remember because he was an East Coast guy. He was New York. He was Long Island, Queens, and he would do some work for the WWF, which I guess was the three W's and an F, but would also work a lot of the independents. He was married to Kitty Adams. And Kitty Adams was a female wrestler, and they were actually featured in a 1977 copy of People Magazine, an issue of People Magazine, where they were listed as the only married couple in professional wrestling, which wasn't true. at all. So great. Yeah,
Johnny
job
Weaver and Penny Banner might have differed on that one.
Yeah, yeah. Johnny Weaver, Penny Bannard, the many wives of Dick Steinborn. I think he was married to a female wrestler, Bobby Peterson and Greg Peterson. There was a lot. There were a lot that were out there. Ripper Collins and Barbara Baker. But so Mark Tendler was a guy that if you ever see a photo of him, he was kind of a barrel-chested guy, not a muscular guy, but a big guy. He was described by people that knew him as a Goomba. So he was, it was said that he ran in circles with organized crime. So, there was a couple of rumors, and this one I saw online. This might have even been Wikipedia. Said he started his career out in the early 1960s as a valet to the legendary Gorgeous George. I don't know about that one because I found results where he was working in Florida in 1958. So that I don't know. And I believe he started his career in the 50s. I don't think he ever worked with Gorgeous George, but I could be wrong with that. Tendler was also an actor. He had a small role in The Odd Couple as a bouncer in a bar, and also was a guy who was a legitimate bouncer in many bars throughout New York. Also famous for training the Sandman. So if you've ever seen the Sandman wrestle, and is that a stretch, Jeff, when I say Sandman wrestle? Yeah. Well,
don't say that to an ECW fan because you'll get in a huge argument.
Yeah, which is probably true, but he has worked the gimmick successfully for about 25 or 30 years. So I give him a lot of credit for that. But he was a guy, he was a bouncer. He was known to have some sort of ties to organized crime. And when you saw him, he looked like a tough guy. He was, the description of him was definitely a tough guy. Well, it all came to an end in the early 90s. Where it was, I'm trying to think exactly what the date was, but it was February 1990. 57-year-old Mark Tendler was killed by a gunshot wound to the head as he sat in his car in the parking lot of the Crazy Clown Topless Bar in Wading River, which is in Suffolk County, Long Island. He was on life support. He died 2 days later. So in a nutshell, you've got a 57-year-old ex-wrestler sitting in his car outside of the Crazy Clown Topless Bar, and somebody just walks up on him, puts one in the head, and he's done. He's out. So a couple of things with this, too. And I should say, too, his murder's never been solved. I think we're going to safely come up with a very viable theory as to who did kill him, allegedly, as we like to say. But as Tendler was killed, he was actually looking to purchase the Crazy Clown at the time that he was killed. Apparently, he had already worked at several either strip clubs, topless bars out in Long Island, New York, and was also partners. He had partnered in with a couple of these.
That's a solid financial investment, by the way, purchasing a strip club.
It is too. It is definitely. This was not the first murder to ever occur, though, at the Crazy Clown. Some 7 or 8 years earlier, 1983, a Thomas Green brutally murdered and sexually assaulted a bartender named Yvonne Hogan with a jagged leg of a bar stool. A crime for which he was convicted and sentenced for. So this is not a place you want to take the kids. You're not going to plan a vacation around this. This is some shit goes down here, Jeff. This bar was leveled soon after it closed in the early 90s. So Mark Tendler, interesting guy, again, married to Kitty Adams for years. She did relocate to Florida. She lives, I believe, around Central Florida. They had a daughter, and I won't give out the daughter's name for the reason I'm about to say, but I actually reached out to the daughter to see if we could get her to come on and talk about her father's murder and maybe, you know, hear something new. And she never got back to me. And when I did some research, she has a rap sheet longer than my leg, Jeff, the daughter. So she's 47 years old, and there is a lengthy rap sheet, and there is literally the amount of crimes that she has committed. It's unbelievable. So, you know, I don't know if one has anything to do with the other. She would have lost her father, my guess is, in her late teens or early 20s. But Mark Tendler is a guy. So what I did do is I did some research and I reached out to people that may have known him. And I got some quotes. Now, the first quote I took off of a message board, and it said, "Tendler was a pretty boisterous fellow and supposedly had said the wrong thing about the wrong guy to the wrong people. He wasn't being a snitch. He just had a big mouth." Well, and again, this is just the word that went around at the time. Tendler had a contract put out on him, and the rest is history. I did reach out to somebody that had spent some time in and around Tendler. Tendler was a kind of a street tough guy. He'd been a bouncer at some tough New York clubs and was known to be an enforcer if someone didn't pay back their loans. He was mixed up with some really serious people, and when you fuck with that, it's going to come back and get you. So I did reach out to a third person who's not involved in wrestling, and it's a third person that's very familiar with organized crime in the United States. And this person basically said Mark Tendler was an enforcer, allegedly, for the Lucchese family, which was running Suffolk County at the time, and I believe still does. Suffolk County, again, is where I believe Tendler lived. It is where the Crazy Clown Topless Bar was, and it was a town that was basically being run by the Lucchese family.
Let me just clarify. Are you trying to allege that a strip club could have certain criminal elements associated with it, allegedly? Because that is something I have never heard of before, and I know the good folks in that particular group, family, would have nothing to do with this. Let me make that perfectly clear.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it was once said that every strip club in the United States was being run by organized crime at one point or another, organized criminals. So yes,
we're going to go to Howard Baum for an update on that story in an upcoming episode.
Yeah, right. So the Lucchese family apparently was running the strip club. He was trying to buy into the strip club. He was shot in his car outside of the strip club. Nobody saw anything, Jeff. Nobody ever talked. Nothing ever happened. Mark Tendler dead.
Well, it's interesting, Barry. You used an interesting phrase there. The phrase you used to describe the crime that resulted in his death was that no one saw a thing. Is that pretty much what you said?
That's exactly what I said. Nobody
saw. That's interesting, because that brings me to my third story. That's what we call a segue in the business, folks. I am the king of segues here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry. No one saw a thing. It happens to be the name of a documentary that at the time of this recording is currently being broadcast on the Sundance Channel. Barry, have you had a chance to see this program yet?
I have not, and I had no idea that was the name.
Well, let me tell you a little about this. We, in a previous Unsolved Mysteries episode, had discussed the death of Ken Rex McElroy in Skidmore, Missouri. In 1981, it ended up becoming a movie starring Brian Dennehy, where this guy was the town bully who was essentially murdered by the entire town. A group of some 30 people or approximately that number surrounded his pickup truck with him and his young wife. And he was murdered. So those of you that are longtime listeners will remember that story that we discussed, and a murder that is still unsolved. I want to recommend this show because it's really interesting. But besides looking back at the death of Ken Rex McElroy, it also discusses some rather strange things that are going on in the town of Skidmore, Missouri, a town that in a recent article was described as, quote, the creepiest small town in America. Let me tell you some of the stuff, Barry, that have happened in Skidmore, Missouri in the last, 30 or 40 years. This is a town of about 300, maybe 400 people, okay? So what are the odds that this many crimes happen? And this is just the murders. I'm not getting into any other nefarious activities that may have happened. So, Barry, in 2000, a young woman named Wendy Gillenwater was, here's a phrase you don't see often, stomped to death by her boyfriend and killed. It was a crime that was reminiscent. Here's a way back name, Barry. Have you ever heard the name Kitty Genovese?
Yeah, that's really funny, Jeff, that you say Kitty Genovese. Was this the lady that I think became famous, her murder became famous because she was killed outside of, I guess, an apartment building, and a lot of people, she was screaming and a lot of people heard it and nobody did anything to stop it?
Yeah, that happened in 1964. 37 people sat there and basically watched this woman get killed. And much like that, in this town of Skidmore, Missouri, Wendy Gillenwater in 2000 is stomped to death by her drug-addled boyfriend and a bunch of neighbors, apparently. Now, obviously, we're not dealing as a close an area as, you know, somewhere in the middle of like New York City. But her neighbors are like hearing this woman scream bloody murder, literally, that her boyfriend, who's apparently, like a meth head or something like that, and just starts beating the bejesus out of her, a guy that apparently had a history of kicking the hell out of her. And so they sit there and just watch this woman being beaten to death. Now, that's OK. That's one thing. So you could say, oh, OK, well, it's 20 years after Ken McElroy. This one thing. No, but then we have. Let's see. In 2001, April 11th, we have a young man named Branson Perry who mysteriously disappears, literally going out to a shed to return. I think it's like a garden hose or something like that. And then he never returns. This kid's murder or disappearance, death, whatever, has never been solved. They've never found the body of this kid, Barry. Now, here's what really gets twisted. OK, we're going to get in some twisted stuff here with this story. So time goes by. There's billboards all around the area. Anybody have any clues? Well, they start doing a little digging. Apparently, there was quite the meth situation going on in the small town of Skidmore, Missouri, and there may have been some allegations that Branson was maybe involved. He knew some dealers and got mixed up with the wrong crowd, and maybe they had something to do with his death. That's just one of the suppositions. Then there's a guy named Jack Wayne Roberts, who gets popped. Jack Wayne Roberts, oh my God, Barry, you want to go down a rabbit hole with one twisted, sick mother effer. Look up the name Jack Wayne Roberts. He ends up doing time for like child porn in a federal prison. But apparently he is on some website or a message group, and he's detailing how he had murdered some kid from nearby in a small town in Missouri, and how he had chopped up the corpse and, you know, just really disgusting details. So they think that maybe he had something to do with it. But then they did an investigation and found out that he apparently was just looking for some publicity or something like that. But there's all kind of weird twists to that story. But wait, there is more. Then in December of 2004, a young woman named Bobby Jo Stennett, oh, by the way, a cousin of the aforementioned Branson Perry, who is pregnant. She's like about 8 months pregnant. She belongs online to a group that promotes the rat terrier dog breed. Okay, they adopt them out to homes that are looking for rat terriers or breeding them. There's a group pretty much for anything that you want to think of being a part of. There's a group on the internet. Well, who knew there was a group for people that are fans of rat terriers? But anyway, so this woman reaches out to her and says, oh, if you have any for adoption, I would love to get a rat terrier. She comes, she invites, oh yeah, come, I'll sell you this rat terrier puppy that I have, okay? And 8 month pregnant Bobby Jo Stennett is killed. Barry, the baby is surgically cut out of her stomach, okay? They find the woman dead. The baby is missing. There's like a 5-state search for this baby. The baby's name was Victoria. They found the baby, Barry. They found baby Victoria with a woman named Lisa Montgomery. And Lisa Montgomery, apparently, needless to say, a little on the bipolar side, and a woman who had been a victim of some, if you look up her name, had been a victim of some horrible physical abuse at the hands of her parents that involved not only physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse. And so she is bipolar and starts telling people in her town, which she lived like in another state, that, oh, yeah, I'm getting ready to have a baby. And in fact, she was, in fact, not pregnant at all. And so she goes, joins us. She's in this rad terror group, goes, and she kills the woman and steals her baby out of her stomach. I can't imagine anything more horrifying than this. So they do this long search. So they end up finding the woman, Lisa Montgomery. They put her on trial. She's in prison for life, much like the guy that killed poor Wendy Gillenwater. He's in prison for life. Barry, Skidmore, Missouri. There is some sick shit going down in that town. And it's not just the death of Ken Rex McElroy.
No, and it just even the name Skidmore, Missouri, it's almost like you couldn't even make that up. That just sounds terrible. I'll tell you, when you do talk about the murder of Kenneth McElroy, too, there's a lot of similarities to the movie Roadhouse, where they, you know, they get him at the end and, you know, the cops come and it's like, I didn't see anything. Did you see anything? No, I didn't see anything. Did you see anything? And the guy was an asshole bully. So I wonder if what year did that happen with Kenneth McElroy?
That happened July 10th, 1981.
Yeah, I wonder if Roadhouse, if there's a little bit of liberties that were taken based off of that. That whole cutting the child out of the womb. And there's been several of these stories. I know I read one that I believe occurred earlier this year. And I remember looking at the mother who was murdered, and she was stunning. I believe she was Native American, and just thinking, what a horrific way to die, first off, knowing what's happening. But if you do that, I mean, that is, to me, I'm speechless. Just such a horrible, horrible thing to do.
Yeah, it's just completely out there. So we'll post links to some of the stuff. And I would encourage folks, if you're interested in, I know we have people on our Facebook group that are into the true crime stuff. And just researching the town of Skidmore, Missouri, and the number of murders that have taken place. And there are people, of course, that have said, you know, is the town cursed? Things like that. And I'm just trying to see some of it. Right now, there's 250 people there. Go figure, because I'm sure everyone is considering moving to this fine community where all this stuff has happened. But it is, one of the things that the TV show talks about, is that are the sins of the father being put down, or cast upon the children? Because now what you're dealing with, the people that live there, are the children of the town, of the adults that were there when Ken Rex McElroy was killed. And you know what's really funny? And I don't mean humorously, Barry. I mean odd, is that there are people there, and they showed an old interview where they were asking them, do you know anybody that was there that day? And they're like, no, I don't know. The town has gone silent on this, and nobody will admit, not just complicity, but like even knowing anybody that may have been, like nobody dropped a dime on anybody, which either tells you there's something really wrong with this town, or boy, that Ken Rex McElroy was such a bad mofo that everyone thought he deserved it and took the law into their own hands. And one of the things that's interesting about this, I don't want to call it a mini series, but that's kind of what it is. There's six episodes. And when this podcast comes out on Tuesday, the last episode will be Thursday night on the Sundance channel. So what they do is first one or two episodes had to deal with Ken Rex McElroy. And looking back on the crime, they interview his children and they talk, there's interviews with his wife. Oh, yeah, by the way, here's another little tidbit for those of you that have forgot the Ken Rex McElroy story. His wife, at the time, I want to say was maybe 16, 17 years old.
Right.
Now, what makes this even more compelling is that, by the way, Ken was married to another woman at the time that he married, this 16, 17-year-old Trina. I can't remember her last name right now. I'm just kind of winging it here. But Trina, he went to Trina's parents because she was still, I want to say, like a freshman or a sophomore in high school when he met her, and said, yeah, I want to marry your daughter. Mom and dad said, no, we don't think so. Our daughter is still in high school. And, Ken was like 45 years old or whatever at the time. And, suddenly mom and dad's house burned down the next day. Coincidence, I'm sure. And he was a guy that just completely, absolutely terrorized this community, even more so than the character in Roadhouse. You were talking about the Ben Gazzara character from the movie Roadhouse, Barry?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And even more than that guy did, you know, because this was not a guy that had a gang of men that, that terrorized. This was one guy who right. was a bully who could just, you know, if you looked at him sideways, you know, there was a guy that made an allegation. He ran a, like a country store, and one of Ken Rex McElroy's young children came in, and they thought the kid had stolen a piece of candy. And they just said, hey, you know, put that down. You shouldn't do that. And the kid's like, well, I wasn't taking it. And the kid went home and mentioned it to his dad. The dad came with a gun and shot the storekeeper right in the stomach. And he had gotten arrested, was set to go to trial, had been released from jail on bond because certainly he's no threat to the community, Barry. But and then that's when the incident happened where he gets killed. And Skidmore, Missouri, not a place that we want to visit anytime in the near future, Barry. Some horrific, horrific stories coming out of there and many unsolved mysteries and death for a town that small, Barry. That is just a wee bit odd.
Yeah, Skidmore, too. I'll always go back to that. And, you know, who the fuck comes up with a name like Skidmore and then all this shitty stuff takes place? You see what I did there, Jeff?
Yeah. But so anyway, so all right, folks, as we're going to start wrapping up here. Let me just tell you, folks, when we now passed episode 100, we are getting into the 101s and 102s and that sort of things. And here on Breaking Kayfabe, besides our YouTube page, which, by the way, let me again mention that you can go on YouTube and subscribe to Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. And we do appreciate that. We'll be putting up some more content, more good stuff, some past interviews that we've done. Our man Sweet Lou is going to be working diligently on that. But I also want to announce that beginning next episode, we are known for Barry looking at matches in the 70s and the 80s. I think we had one match from the 60s. That Von Erich Baba match was even in the 60s. So we covered a lot of ground. But after convening a special group of wrestling fans and historians, I reached out to a large group and said, what are your favorite matches of the 1990s? And so we're going to start looking at some great matches from the 1990s as recommended by some of the members of this group. We will identify who has made the suggestion that we look at this match. And so, Barry, I know you're looking forward to looking at some stuff from the 1990s. We're getting close.
Yeah, there's a great list of matches, and kudos to you on this one, too, because you kind of took the reins and kind of organized it and came up with this entire deal on the 90s. But look, there was some great wrestling. Yeah, I'm definitely an 80s guy. I think you're an 80s guy as well. But looking at some of these matches, it's going to be fun over the next 6 months or a year, or however long it's going to be.
I can 2 years, that whatever it is. At the behest of Barry Rose, and by the way, Barry, I think that's the first time we've ever used the word behest.
I like it.
We will not be doing four matches a week. Barry said, no, I don't think so. I've got better things to do in Ambler, PA than do four matches a week. So, but we're very excited, and we hope you look forward to more stuff, more interviews. Barry and I were just talking about a potential guest we're going to have for next week that I will not announce because God forbid I do, and the person decides they can't make it. That would be kind of bad. So I would encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff, Breaking Kayfabe, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. 100 episodes, Barry, 100 episodes without a miss. And thank you to our man Lou Kippelman once again on production duties. And until next week, matches from the 90s.